Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is John Thompson, Professor of Sociology at Cambridge University, and author of Merchants of Culture, a fascinating exploration of the publishing business in the 21st century. Right at the outset, John declares his intention to study the publishing industry in the way that an anthropologist would study the practices of a tribe inhabiting some remote island in the South Pacific. And he's as good as his word. He went among the publishing tribe and conducted hundreds of interviews as part of his research, sitting down with publishers, booksellers, agents and authors in order to see the often seemingly irrational practices of the publishing world from an insider perspective. The result is a book which is both more analytically sophisticated than previous accounts of the business and also much more widely informed by the everyday challenges, frustrations and satisfactions of real people's jobs. John Thompson presents publishing as a dynamic field of cultural activity, in which the power relations between the key players are never static. To understand the field, he argues convincingly, it's not enough just to talk to the publishers, since their actions are continually being influenced by the author's agents, on one hand, and by the retail chains on the other, both of which groups have achieved a marked increase in their power in the course of the last two or three decades. Indeed, fewer players wielding ever greater power has been a defining characteristic of publishing's most recent phase. Then add electronic publishing into the mix, and you begin to get a sense of just what a volatile, potentially exciting, but equally disruptive time the publishing industry is currently experiencing. We turn to all these subjects later in the interview, but I began with one of the implications of John Thompson's title. Publishers are merchants, yes, but the commodity they bring to the market is cultural. And in a cultural economy, the amount of money in your bank account may matter, but so too does the amount of symbolic capital you hold. I asked John to expand on this concept.
Well, publishing is fundamentally this mixture of economics and culture. You need financial resources in order to be a player in the field, but you are engaged fundamentally in questions of value and judgments of taste. So publishers find themselves working with different forms of resource, or what I call capital, following Bourdieu. One is economic capital. They need money in order to operate as a player in the field. But they also need other kinds of resource. And one of these other forms of resource is what we could call symbolic capital, by which I mean prestige and status that they are able to build up over time. And they build it up in various ways. They build it up by winning prizes, for example, for their books. So winning a prize like the Booker Prize is very significant for a publishing house because not only does it, of course, stimulate the sales of the book, that's important, but just as importantly, it gives them prestige. It gives them standing. It gives them a kind of cultural value. It raises their standing in the field, and that strengthens their position when it comes to acquiring new authors and persuading new authors to sign with them. If they are a prestigious publisher, then other authors will want to sign with them. So if you are a poet, then you want to be published by Faber, because Faber is the house that has published many great poets. Or if you are a novelist, you want to be published by a publisher like Knopf or Farrar Straus or whatever. These are houses which have a tradition of publishing high-quality literary work, and you want to be in the company of all those other great writers. So it greatly strengthens the position of the publisher when they are competing for new content.
Now, there's a certain view, I think, that the very big publishing conglomerates are, to put it crudely, perhaps a little bit philistine, less risk-taking, less cultural, perhaps, in their attitudes. And this was a myth that you interrogated. What did you find?
It's a myth because it's based on a fundamental misconception of what these large corporate groups are. They are, in most cases, very disaggregated conglomerates with many different publishing imprints in houses under their umbrella. They vary considerably in the extent to which they try to centralize activities. Some are more centralized than others, but some are very federal. They allow the publishing houses that they have acquired to remain pretty much autonomous and to do whatever they want to do. And some of those publishing houses are very much oriented towards publishing works of quality as well as works that are going to make them some money. They generally operate within certain financial parameters, so they have to make their numbers, as they will say. But so long as they make their numbers, they can do more or less what they like in terms of publishing the range of titles they want to publish. Moreover, many of the large conglomerates do have the view that as a publishing organization, as a publisher, they want to generate not only money and successful books, but also works of quality. They want both on their list. So it matters to them not only to have a bestseller, but also to win the Booker Prize or to win some other prestigious prize, because part of what they think of themselves as being as publishers, as is organizations that produce a wide range of works from best-selling commercial fiction through to high-quality literary fiction or serious biography, history, and nonfiction.
A lot of energy and a lot of money in publishing is expended in the search for the next bestseller. But as you point out, no one ever buys a bestseller. They only buy a hoped-for bestseller, which I think emphasizes the degree to which uncertainty is really built into the whole game, isn't it?
Absolutely. The concept that is used within the industry and that you come up against again and again as you begin to talk to people in the industry is the notion of the big book. Many publishers will commonly talk about big books rather than bestsellers as such. They are always looking for big books, and big books are hugely significant for the industry. The natural inclination is to think that a big book is a bestseller, but in fact, if you study the dynamics of the industry, you see very quickly that the big book cannot be a bestseller. It can be, at most, a hoped-for bestseller, because when it is acquired, when it is competed for in auctions, no one knows whether it's going to become a bestseller. You simply think it might be a bestseller. And so a great deal of energy is expended in trying to persuade others that what you have here, which is just a proposal or maybe a draft manuscript, is a bestseller. That is some kind of big book. It's something about which you should get excited and you should be willing to pay a lot of money because it may turn out to be a bestseller. Now, I'm leaving aside here the question of the brand name authors like Grisham or Stephen King or authors like that, where they have a large audience which buys their books again and again and again, and therefore they have a very predictable sales pattern. That's a different category altogether. But for most new books and many new authors, you simply don't know how well the book is going to do. And so you are in the process of persuading others and persuading yourselves that this could be the next big thing, though you don't know whether it will be, because the truth is, no one knows. So one of the questions that I pursued was to try to figure out why it is that in these large corporate houses there was such a preoccupation with big books. In order to understand that, you have to see that these large corporate publishing houses are characterized by a fundamental dilemma, what I call the growth conundrum. And the growth conundrum, simply put, is this: as publishing houses which are owned by a large corporation, in some cases publicly quoted, in other cases privately held, they have to meet certain financial targets. They have to grow year on year. They have to grow by hopefully something like 8 to 10% per year, and they have to try to achieve a level of profitability somewhere in excess of 10% every year. Now, the problem for the senior managers in these large publishing houses is that the market for trade books is largely static. It's growing only at the rate of inflation. And that's the growth conundrum. How do you achieve significant levels of growth in a market that is largely static? And that's the problem that every one of these publishing houses has to grapple with. You might think the solution is easy. You simply publish more books. But in fact, that's not a solution at all. Because you have already, as a large publishing corporation, acquired so many publishing houses that you are perhaps publishing 1,500 or 2,000 books every year. And at the same time, you've consolidated your sales forces. So your poor sales force is out there trying to sell 2,000 books every year, 2,000 new product lines every year. You can't give them more product lines to try to sell. They're simply going to be overwhelmed. So the alternative strategy is the one that most of these large corporations have settled upon, which is don't publish more books, publish fewer books, but sell more copies of every book you publish. And that means that you try to cut out what's called the mid-list, which are those books on your list that are not selling that many copies, and focus your attention more and more on the bigger books. And so that's the basic explanation for why the industry becomes increasingly preoccupied with big books.
Another way, it seemed to me, in which polarization was taking place was the environment in which books are discussed and promoted and knowledge about them is transmitted. Because on one hand, well, you've got the newspapers, which are shrinking, the old traditional media shrinking. On the other, you've got the opera and the Richard and Judy phenomenon, sort of making bestsellers and selling six and seven figures. And on the other hand, you've got the sort of micro sites, you know, the bloggers and the little fish, as it were. So that, again, there seemed to be polarization at work in the industry.
Yes, I think there is another dimension of this that you're alluding to here, which is the structure of the marketplace. And what you have in the marketplace is a declining range of avenues for securing visibility for your titles. So the review space is declining because newspapers are losing advertising revenue and they are closing down their book review sections or shrinking them. So the amount of space out there for review coverage is declining. The traditional avenues available to you for achieving visibility for your titles are shrinking. So you are forced to make decisions about which of your new titles you're going to back, which you're going to put a lot of resource behind, and which you're going to leave really to one side or simply put out there in the marketplace and hope for the best. You concentrate your resource on those titles that you think you can achieve the greatest success with. And for those titles, you do try to achieve some visibility in the media, whether it's television, radio, or the press. But you also spend a lot of money getting books into that very visible space at the front of the bookstore, which is the sacred ground of the trade publishing industry. That front space in Barnes & Noble and Waterstones and so on, where books are instantly and immediately visible when you walk into the bookstore. That is the space of high churn, where books sell, if they sell at all, they sell in large numbers. But to get your books in that space, you have to spend a lot of money. It's very expensive. And so publishers are going to be very selective about the titles they put in that front of store high churn space. It costs roughly about $1 a book to put books in that space. And you can't afford to keep them there for very long. So if they are not selling, you pull them out very quickly. Books don't have long to make it in this space, just 2 or 3 weeks maybe. And if they're showing no signs of taking off, you pull them out of there. The overall consequence of this is that there is a struggle for visibility in these spaces where publishers are able to bring their books to the attention of potential buyers and readers. And the large publishing houses have greater muscle, greater power to achieve visibility in these spaces because they have the resource to put their books in those spaces and to take more chances with them. And the books that do succeed tend to take a larger and larger share of the market. So what you see happening over time is not a winner-takes-all marketplace, but what I call a winner-takes-more marketplace. That is, you have a small number of titles taking a larger and larger share of the retail market. So you have runaway bestsellers like Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, which sold many millions of copies in hardback and took a large share of the market, or Harry Potter, again, huge successes which are able to take a large share of the market in a market that, remember, is largely overall static.
Now, we're talking about books working or not working. And of course, when a book doesn't work, it has an impact on its author. And you also investigated some of the ways in which the role of the author, the expectations of the author, have changed in recent years.
Of course, every author is unique and every author will have their own story to tell. But I found time and time again a story emerging of authors whose lives had been bruised by this industry and by the short-termism of the industry, by the way that the industry was very focused on achieving strong sales as quickly as possible. I followed the stories of numerous authors who had decided they wanted to become writers and had found an agent and who had began publishing 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 books with varying degrees of success, and then were suddenly cut loose by their agents and their publishers and left to drift out to sea without a publisher, without an agent, and so on. In many ways, casualties of an industry that was focused on achieving success as quickly as possible and willing to cut loose authors if their sales were not displaying the patterns that they wanted to see.
We've talked about the changing dynamics between those three key players, the retailers, the agents, and the publishers. But towards the end of the book, you bring on what might be termed outsiders who are having a crucial, or who will in the future, have crucial determining influence on the industry. I'm thinking of people like Apple and Google and the Sonys of this world, who will have direct bearing on how the content which publishers publish is actually handled in the marketplace, how it's valued and all those things. So it's incredibly uncertain, potentially exciting, but potentially erosive kind of time ahead, isn't it, for publishing?
It is, and there is nothing that generates more anxiety and uncertainty than talk about the digital revolution in publishing. I spent a lot of time analyzing what's at stake in this, and it's hugely important for the industry. There's no question about that. But it's also something that is very often misunderstood by outsiders. Many journalists look at the publishing industry and see it as rather old-fashioned, like an antediluvian gentleman in his tweed jacket, resistant to the changes of technology that have swept through other creative industries like music, and think that the only indication of whether publishing enters the digital age will be the success or otherwise of ebooks. They get excited when they see another piece of technology like the Kindle or the iPad released and sales increase, of ebooks increase, and that excites them. And they think that suddenly, at last, the industry is waking up to the digital revolution. That's a view that I don't share and that I'm very critical of in my work. And I'm critical of it because it's very superficial. It's based on a very superficial understanding of how technology transforms complex in creative industries like publishing. And I try to analyze the complexity of this process in some detail by going inside of the industry and trying to understand how the digital revolution has changed the world of publishing over the last 20 years. And it is a transformation that goes back to the 1980s. The really fundamental change has been what I call the hidden revolution. And by that, I mean that the digital revolution in publishing is not so much a revolution in product. That is, it's not in the object that you as the consumer buy, whether it's a physical book or an ebook. The real revolution is a revolution in process. It's the process by which the content itself is produced and transformed by the industry. And from the mid to late 1980s on, this revolution in process has been underway. So that by the late 1990s, a book from the viewpoint of a production manager in a publishing house was simply a digital file. So the whole workflow within publishing has been digitally reconstituted up to the point at which The file is delivered to a printer for printing. So the question of whether the final product is bought as a physical book or as an e-book is only one aspect of the digital revolution. It's like the tip of the iceberg, but the submerged iceberg is much larger than the outside observer is inclined to see. Having said all that, the question of how you deliver that content, whether you deliver it as a physical book or deliver it as a electronic file that is read on a reader like the Kindle or the iPad, is in itself an important question. It undoubtedly will continue to have a growing impact on the industry and the way that it works. Up till now, that so-called e-book revolution has remained a rather small part of trade publishing. Up to 2006, it was a minute part of the trade publishing world, less than probably 0.2%. But with the release of the Sony eBook Reader and then the Kindle and now the iPad, sales of eBooks have undoubtedly increased very significantly in the United States and have grown, sales have grown at a quite striking rate. Nevertheless, even with that growth, it still remains a small part of the industry. It remains probably less than 2% of trade sales in the US. That is undoubtedly going to change in the coming years and decades. How significant it will become is anyone's guess. No one knows the answer to that question. The publisher doesn't need to know the answer to that question, because what the publisher controls is content, and the publisher must be in a position to ensure that the content they control can be delivered through different pipelines, whatever pipelines consumers decide they want to receive that content in, whether it's the traditional print on paper book or whether it's the internet as a pipeline through which they receive their reading content. The publisher can remain neutral and agnostic about that question, but they have to be sure that the content they have can be delivered in a variety of different media and modalities.
The book is called Merchants of Culture, which I read as containing at least an implicit tension there between the demands of the marketplace and what one might see as a sort of the service of culture. So my last question is this: how does one arrive at some judgment about whether the culture is being well served by the publishing industry or whether it's gradually dumbing down?
That's a very difficult question, and I resist any overall judgment of that kind. There are people who make that argument, that what we're seeing with the rise of the large conglomerates in the publishing industry is a dumbing down of culture. We see questions of quality being marginalized as the publishers that occupy the center ground are preoccupied only by bestsellers and maximum financial return. I take the view that this world is much more complicated than that picture would suggest. You can see that simply by realizing that at the same time as we've witnessed the growing concentration of large publishing houses, we've also seen a proliferation in the number of titles being produced. Large numbers of books are being published, more than ever before. And so this is not a field which is characterized by a dwindling output of titles. On the contrary, more books than ever before are now being published. So I think it would be hard to make the argument that, taken as a whole, the publishing industry is producing books of less quality than they were in the past. That seems, you can make that out, you can try to make that argument, but I think it's going to be hard to sustain it. I think for me, the more serious issues are about the short-termism of the industry, as we've been discussing, and the fact that it is becoming a marketplace in which winners take more, so that even though more and more books are being published, many, many of those books are being published into oblivion. No one notices them. They simply don't get seen by anyone because the marketplace is very crowded and the powerful players have the leverage to ensure that their books are the ones that are seen and read and consumed, whereas many of those other books that have been poured into the marketplace are simply being neglected. That seems to me to be the serious source of concern, as well as the capacity of the industry to nurture talent over time. I think there is a short-termism in the industry that cuts off careers abruptly, and therefore the ability of an author to be nurtured over the long term is being foreshortened, and that seems to me to be a serious source of concern.
John Thompson. Merchants of Culture is available now from Polity in hardback. There are more details about this book and all of Polity's titles on the website, which you'll find at polity.co.uk. That's all for this Polity podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme in the series. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.